Good afternoon, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Year in Review. This is the day we talk about the management of lung cancer, specifically the use of immunotherapy and non-target approaches, and key papers and presentations that have occurred in the past year. Today, we're really fortunate to be working with Dr. Matt Gubins from the University of California, San Francisco. As always, if you have any questions or cases you'd like to run by us, just type them into the chat room and we'll talk about as many of these as we have time. As always, we have a one-minute pre-meeting and post-meeting survey in the chat room. If you take that, you'll get a lot more out of this meeting as well. We know a lot of people end up listening to our webinars. If you're into podcasts, check out our Oncology Today series, including a recent program with Drs. Gaynor and our camp that we put out there. We do webinars all the time. Tomorrow, we're going to do a post-ASCO program looking at renal cell carcinoma, see what's up there, and particularly in terms of first-line therapy. On Thursday, we'll be doing a program on triple-negative breast cancer. We got a bunch of great cases we're presenting by video to our faculty on Thursday. Next week, we'll be back with gynecologic oncology, what's been happening over the past year there, particularly a lot of stuff in endometrial cancer relevant to what we're talking about today in terms of immunotherapy. On Tuesday, July 9th, we'll be doing year in review multiple myeloma. I was just thinking, we just did a melanoma program, Matt, recently. We were talking about the Nadine neoadjuvant trial the other day. I was making a note to ask you about that, so we're going to bring that up. We're going to do another breast cancer program, triple negative disease, on July the 17th. Program on ALK-targeted therapy in lung cancer on the 18th. But today we're here to talk about immunotherapy and other non-targeted approaches to lung cancer. We'll be talking also about the use of non-approved agents and regimens. So check the package inserts for more information. There have been a ton of great papers and presentations, including at the ASCO meeting recently, that are relevant to the topics today. You can check out a lot of the specifics in the slide set that we have in the chat room. We'll bring up a bunch of these papers as we go along here today. But there's a lot to talk about, and we want to make it as relevant as possible, as we always do, to docs in practice. So here's where we're heading. We're going to start out with a little bit of a warm-up, talking about checkpoint inhibitors, not just year in review, but I'm going to call it 9 years in review. And then we're going to jump into a bunch of papers from this past year and talk about kind of what it means. So, Matt, I was reflecting back on this program we did. You may wonder why I'm bringing up a program on GU cancer that we did in February 2015. But at the end of that conference on the video, there's a little 3-minute segment that's been circulated around now for the last 9 years, where I go to the audience. I know we're talking about GU cancer today, but there was a press release this morning on Nivo in non-small cell, and it looks like it maybe is going to get approved. And if it does, things are going to change like you never would believe, and your infusion rooms are not going to be looking the same. Your life is not going to be the same. Here's a poll question we asked those people at the meeting. We said, if an IO like Nivo is approved in lung cancer, what are you going to do? And of course, a quarter of the audience said, I have no idea. The other rest of the audience says, well, maybe first line, maybe second line. They were not ready. We were not ready. And now here we are 9 years later. And this is from a talk you just gave at the ASCO meeting. Great presentation, Matt. And I wanted to put this out here in the beginning, because in that talk, and I really recommend people to check out the talk, because Matt goes through all the targeted therapies. But I just want you to let's just remember how many targeted therapies there are out there right now, 20 years later, I guess. And as we go through today, we're not just going to talk about people who don't have any of these things, but we're also going to talk about these people and what you do once you get through with targeted therapy. So we're going to try to work that in as well. Again, just a reminder, now we got HER2, mutation, overexpression, pan-tumor expression. So I just, one other thing before we jump into it. I saw this paper in your CV, Matt, and I was just thinking, wow, 9 years ago, we didn't even know what we're doing. Now we're doing this. And this is just as a sort of a warm-up. We had a video we used at the ASCO meeting recently where one of the oncologists said, He said, I feel like half of these people come in with some kind of history of colitis, and I'm not sure what are the types of colitis I ought to be worrying about, et cetera. And I saw your paper looking, I guess this is, maybe you can explain what you did here.
Yeah, I mean, this is something we wouldn't have dreamed of 9 years ago. You're right, a wild trip it's been. But yeah, this is some really bright geneticists working with huge data sets, and you develop a polygenic risk score based on a spit kit, right? What they do is they go back,
germline.
Look at, yeah, exactly. You look at 24,000 people who have Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis, figure out how their allelic expression differs from those who are normal controls. And then you apply that risk score to a set of lung cancer patients who have had immunotherapy. And what you find is the genetic factors that predict for ulcerative colitis also predict for colitis on therapy. And, you know, so what you see here is you can identify, you know, a group of people who are at the 90th percentile on this risk score who are very likely, kind of 15 to 20%, to have an honest to goodness serious colitis you have to manage. And so that's something that is not high enough to deprive anyone based on that score. So this is more hypothesis generating. But again, this slide you're showing tells us that even if these patients get colitis and you look at their survival curves compared to everyone else, it's at least as good. Now, survivor bias is a big issue here. The more time you're on immunotherapy, the more time you have to develop immune-related adverse events. But it's reassuring. But just kind of this nuance of thinking about the hosts, their microbiome, their personal genetics, the tumor microenvironment, the tumor itself. Again, it's such a multiplex a world to have to think about when we think about not just response, but even toxicity.
Yeah, and this certainly is a practical issue in terms of managing patients and, you know, deciding maybe who to follow more carefully. I guess maybe at this point it's not exactly ready for prime time. But again, it also raises something that we've been talking about right from the beginning, and I'm still not sure of the answer, which is that what you kind of alluded to here, which is there a relationship between autoimmune toxicity and treatment benefit. I'm not sure 9 years later whether you figured that out, but what's your take?
The data are hard to be rigorous about them. There's that hint though. And I remind patients of that and say, we will grapple with IRAEs as they come, but often even if we stop treatment early, we may see some durable benefit nonetheless. So it's just kind of in the background of as how we counsel patients anticipatorily and then reacting to adverse events that come up.
Right. So that's just kind of an intro to what we're going to talk about. Now we're going to sort of dive into a number of key clinical areas and find out what's happened over the past year, anything that happened that really affected practice, and maybe take a look at a few of the slides, think a little bit about what's coming next, so to speak. So we're going to start out with localized disease, and I'm just going to start out with this list of papers because I think it really capsulizes maybe what's happened over the past year. Maybe you can talk about sort of where you think we were about a year ago in terms of adjuvant, neoadjuvant IOs, where we are today, Matt.
Yeah, sure. A couple of years ago, we first got this kind of this understanding that neoadjuvant chemoimmunotherapy is safe. It yields better pathologic CRs. We don't see path CRs with chemo in lung cancer. And we're finally seeing some event-free survival or even overall survival benefit. So that was the first paradigm. Let's give three cycles of chemo IO before surgery. The last year, what we've seen are some of the data sets looking at perioperative immunotherapy. So four cycles of chemoimmunotherapy, surgery, and then either an extra year or completion of a year total of immunotherapy on the back end. And Dr. Wakely's paper, along with Dr. Spicer, showed us the overall survival benefit of that approach in the perioperative pembrolizumab. And of course, we're waiting for all the other players in this game to also have more mature results and replicate those results as well. But those are our two approvals in the U.S., neoadjuvant alone versus perioperative, I should say.
So I was mentioning we did a melanoma program the other day, and I promised the faculty I was going to ask you about the Nadine study that was a plenary presentation where, you know, we've been hearing about that from Georgina Long and a lot of investigators in melanoma the last few years, and finally here it was. I'm not sure we've seen that with another solid tumor. I don't know that we've seen that with lung cancer, but you tell me. I mean, the thing there was these people did better if they got immunotherapy, neoadjuvantly, a lot better. Any thoughts about that as you look at the current landscape and, you know, some of the papers we just talked about, you know, the CheckMate 816 study, which has really driven practice to a great extent, And then, of course, the perioperative approach with a pembro that you mentioned as well. Any thoughts about where that's heading?
Well, again, before these studies came out in lung cancer, we had the adjuvant data, adjuvant atezolizumab, adjuvant pembrolizumab. And I think there's this realization that treating a tumor in situ may be advantageous. It gives us a readout. We get a pathologic response, maybe a PCR, a partial CR, partial response rather. But I think that that melanoma data is very galvanizing, but it comes with some caveats, right? Melanoma, though it's also very immune responsive, it's also easier to give nivo-ipi before a skin surgery than it is for an intrathoracic surgery. There are some data we're awaiting for CTLA-4 and PD-1 inhibition, but I think that the balance of risk and benefits for now, for the data we have, still favors more of a immunotherapy with just PD-1, PD-L1 inhibition with chemo initially. But again, this field's wide open. And it's changing hearts and minds. I think there was a reluctance among some surgeons to entertain the idea of a tumor treated by immunotherapy, worry about fibrosis, worried about a patient who might develop a pneumonitis that keeps them from the OR. That's our biggest fear, right? But I think there's, with these data and with really rigorous surgical data that come out too from Dr. Spicer and a lot of other surgical colleagues, I think there's a lot more comfort with this approach. So I think it has been a paradigm shift, and that pendulum from do chemo rads and consolidate with immunotherapy for a broader swath of our stage threes. Now some of them are pulling back into the resectable territory, maybe too far, some argue. What's resectable? Do you decide that a priori? You should. I think sometimes there's a hoped for resectability that sometimes we overestimate in our optimism. So it's the pendulum swinging.
So Rubing in the chat room brings up the issue of PD-L1 assays and its relevance to the use of perioperative therapy. And also, I want to raise the issue, you know, again, I know melanoma is not the same as lung cancer. I mean, it was amazing. They had 59% PATCR or whatever, right. And with two doses of ipi-nivo is like amazing. And okay, right. I know that melanoma is not the same, but even so, pretty. And also brings up the issue of durvalumab, which we'll talk more about with metastatic disease, but also I wonder whether, do you think anti-CTLA-4 is going to be part of our neoadjuvant strategy in the future?
You notice we haven't seen those data from 816. So I'll be curious if those pan out. I don't know kind of what we'll see, again, both efficacy-wise, but also safety-wise. Because remember, even in the metastatic setting, we haven't seen a wildly better message for the CTLA-4 PD-1 inhibitors over a PD-1 single agent. We'll see those data in a few minutes, of course.
So the other thing,
question about PD-1, I think all these forest plots, none of the FDA labels depend on PD-L1 expression, but I think in each of the forest plots for PCR and for EFS, you see some signal where there's a gradient for PD-L1. But I always think of that with a little bit of a caveat, because keep in mind that the specimen you're doing that off of is that little FNA or maybe a tiny core if you have good operators, maybe not the only representation of what's happening intratumorally. So that's why it hasn't quite risen to the level of being a selection factor, but it's among the maybe more relative factors you might use to decide pro and con, along with stage and histology and all that.
Yeah, particularly patients where you're sort of on the fence. And speaking about people on the fence, of course, it's not going to be too long for somebody in the chat room is going to say, what about ctDNA? But I'm going to sort of ask, I'll bring it up before they can even bring it up here. But
right?
I mean, colon, obviously, it's very much part of the algorithm. And then oncologists are using it in colon, are doing it in breast and everything else and asking why not. And all the investigators are going, we need more data. But I know there's more presented at ASCO. Any thoughts about ctDNA assisting in this perioperative situation? Are we getting close to that, Matt?
I think so. And all these phase 3 trials are collecting some ctDNA. Sometimes it's how present is it before surgery, after the neoadjuvant therapy? How much is present after surgery? So we're going to see some data parsed out about that. I think the other kind of important situation is intensification versus de-intensification for people who don't get neoadjuvant therapy. There's still going to be a large swath of the patients who see a surgeon first. Maybe they just decide they really, in their heart of hearts, they want to get to surgery, despite our discussion of the benefits potentially of neoadjuvant. Well, after you see that resection, how do we decide who in whom we give adjuvant chemo and adjuvant immunotherapy? And I think, again, the data aren't ready for prime time, but you're seeing these nascent efforts to try to determine that and integrate those data into the trials. This is also interesting. So, like, these are stage one patients to kind of say,
right,
you know, in our current structure, you're not going to give adjuvant anything to a stage one patient. But we also know, you know, a not insignificant proportion of those are destined to recur. And if you can identify them, maybe four cycles of chemo or a year of immunotherapy is a relatively tolerable thing to offer to improve that risk. So I think this is really important risk stratification.
No, I mean, I always found it frustrating that lung people would go, oh, you know, it's only a 25% recurrence rate. You say that in breast cancer and you're going to get adjuvant therapy.
Right, exactly.
And, you know, I mean, if you go from 20% to 17% and it's not a very toxic therapy, at least the patient can decide whether to do it or not. But anyhow, maybe that's going to change with ctDNA. All right, let's talk a little bit. I was confessing to you, I get confused between Flora, Laura, and et cetera, but I think it was Laura. That was one of the, this was a huge year for ASCO. We had three lung plenaries.
ASCO Lung, that's right. That's what we call it.
ASCO Lung, that's what this is, right. So obviously the first one, of course, is something that I guess was not a big surprise because everybody's already doing it, which is, you know, EGFR patients. And we can show the data, but it was everybody expected. It looks great. You know, I'm curious whether people are going to do pre-chemo radiation therapy. I don't know. But meanwhile, the one question everybody's asking that I want to ask you is, what about, getting back to your talk you just gave with the 18 different mutations, like which one of those, if any, are you going to apply the Laura thing? I hear people saying, well, maybe ALK, well, like you got 12, 13 choices. Are you going to use Durva for everything except EGFR?
Right. So I'll be honest with that ASCO talk. I think it was the second question from the audience was exactly what you just asked. So that's on the tips of everyone's tongue. I think I always go back to the point, there's probably more similarities among the EGFR ALK ROS1 group of mutations in terms of what we know about their response to immunotherapies in the metastatic setting, granted, but even in some of the small numbers we have in Pacific and other trials that suggest that it's not helpful. And then to kind of know that they have active TKIs that could do a better job in that setting. Now, obviously, when you're talking about years of therapy with a TKI, we're not just talking about toxicity, which is real, even if it's more modest than chemos or immunotherapies. We're also talking about a financial toxicity. But I think for now, I'm more comfortable extending the analogy of Laura to the ALK situation, acknowledging just as in the adjuvant setting, Adara was positive and then Alina was even more positive. I think it's not implausible to say that an ALK inhibitor would be pretty appropriate at that point if I could get my hands on it. But when we look at some of the other mutations, even though we have target therapies for MET-exon 14 or RET or HER2, these are also mutations that happen in a different demographic set of patients. MET-exon 14 is famous for having a higher representation of people with tobacco history, for example, and patients who we know in the stage 4 setting have actually pretty reasonable immunotherapy outcomes. And so in my personal practice, even before Laura, I would not give consolidation immunotherapy to EGFR, ALK, and ROS1. And I would pretty much offer it to everybody else. Now, in terms of actually using a TKI, I'll now give osimertinib as a consolidative TKI per Laura. I probably try to sneak it for ALK inhibitor, and that's probably where I'd stop as of today.
So, and also I would just want to point out here the top paper there, part of a consensus, really for radiation oncologists, but I thought it was a pretty cool paper where they went through a bunch of scenarios. Here's the paper right here. Particularly, again, it had some specifics about the type of radiation, et cetera. I think for medical oncology, it didn't seem like too much different there, Matt, other than Durva was pretty standard, I guess. And the other thing, too, I should have mentioned is this DUART study, because people have been asking, what about patients who we can get radiation, but you don't want to give them chemo? I think, again, I think people have been doing this already, but I guess we have data now.
Right. I mean, both those last two bullet points, specific R is a real world experience. It actually also included some patients who got sequential chemo and radiation. So, you know, these are patients who, you know, when we were kind of waiting for registration in, I think, mostly a European setting. And we saw that even those patients got benefit. And then DUART, I think, is important because we do have a subset of patients where we can give them palliative radiation, maybe not 60 gray and 30 fractions, but for 40, 35 gray, something like that. And we can get them immunotherapy, but chemo is just not going to be in the cards. Well, DUART showed that that set of patients actually did okay and had a better outcome than you would have normally expected. I want to take one step back, if you don't mind, to Laura. I think one of the other insights of Laura that I neglected to mention, and it was really nicely pointed out by the discussant, Dr. Sequist, who RTP knows and loves, is to kind of point out that the control curve on that study is not as good as the control curve on the Pacific study. Our patients who have stage 3 unresectable EGFR-driven tumors have a very high likelihood of having micrometastatic disease, higher even than the Pacific population. So it just kind of, there's a good news on the trial, but keep in mind that that's partly because the control arm doesn't do very well. And secondly, notice that that's an indefinite use of osimertinib. It's not a 3-year term like we do for Flora. Adara. It's indefinite, reflecting that a large number of these patients really have metastatic disease that we're trying to suppress. Anyway, sorry to interrupt there.
Oh, no. So actually, I was just looking at a case that came into the chat room. This is typical of what oncologists are dealing with. Very simple, except I don't know the answer. 54-year-old woman is from Rubing, stage 2B non-small cell adenocarcinoma, post-op, referred for adjuvant evaluation, planning for adjuvant chemo. You can tell me how much benefit you think that's going to provide. PD-1 is 0, no actionable mutations. Oh, would you give chemo followed by IO, adjuvant chemo? Does IO play a role here? Would you give this patient an IO and how?
First of all, the chemo question, and I think I've maybe talked about this with you years ago. I mean, we're not much further in the chemo world. We have this, I hold up my hand, I say there's about a 5% absolute benefit. And as you know, there are patients who say 1%, I'll take it. Other people who say 5%, what the heck are you talking about 3 months of chemo for? But I would offer it to any stage B patient and talk about the pros and cons. As you might remember, not this year, this is a couple of years ago, but there's kind of a funny disparate result between the atezolizumab immunotherapy adjuvant trial and the pembrolizumab adjuvant trial.
Right.
The atezolizumab, clearly beneficial at PD-L1 50% or higher, kind of middling at 1 to 49 and didn't assess less than 1. Whereas pembro, they went for the whole kit and caboodle. They got approval because they were a positive 0 to 100%. But there was kind of a wonkiness to their data where the 50% and higher didn't do as well as the 1 to 49. So it was kind of not the gradient that you expect. So I think a lot of us scratched our heads about those data. Is it just a fluke? Is it something about the assay, the patients? Who knows? But that has led to my personal practice. If they didn't do neoadjuvant, and when I see them post-op, if they have PD-L1 50% or higher, I strongly recommend it, obviously, as long as there are no actionable genomic alterations. 1 to 49, I have a pretty careful conversation with them and say, here's kind of where the data aren't totally clear, but I would offer it, and here's maybe the toxicity profile we would have to think about. I will mention it to less than 1% because it's an FDA-approved indication, but I would say that based on the preponderance of not just adjuvant but metastatic data, that I really am hard put to suggest it strongly to those patients.
One of the relevant themes here that, you know, has always been an important issue in oncology, and I just feel like we're talking more and more about it. We just did the ONS meeting. It was the whole theme, which is patient advocacy and patient involvement if they want to be involved. If they're a patient that doesn't want to be, that's fine. But for people who want to be involved, and particularly if they have, you know, education or the background to understand some of the subtleties, you know, let them participate, because, you know, I love working with you because you don't mind just saying what you do, understanding that, you know, there are a lot of other evidence-based options, but this is really what oncologists want to hear. Oh, sure. So let's go to another thing that we've been talking about, and you can tell me what we've learned, if anything, over this past year, but a decision that oncologists make every day, which is first-line therapy and the use of immunotherapy. And the issue, and, you know, thinking back to that initial poll question we were asking, whether you use first-line or second-line, in terms of where we are at this point, to me, it seems like mostly what we're looking at is follow-up of the older studies. And we're still, I guess, still with the same question of really, first of all, who should get chemo? And I'm thinking differently about this now, actually, since I saw the FLARA data. Right now, we're giving chemo and osimertinib. Well,
that's right.
Maybe we ought to be thinking about chemo and IO for the same idea, you know, early progression or whatever. And then the other thing you see down there at the bottom, durvalumab, which is the role of anti-CTLA-4, particularly with people with low PD-1.
So to I guess, point, first though, of all, yeah, my question OC is a great drug, and I haven't, this isn't a targeted talk. I haven't kind of,
right.
I haven't moved to an OC plus chemo. There's a lot of interesting chat about that you'll have with the other team over there. But I think this is so different because you have those patients who have PD-L1 greater than 50%, especially the higher the PD-L1, the better. They are destined right. to enjoy such long duration of benefit without the need for chemo. And always with the caveats, they don't have a high burden of disease. I have a lot of confidence, though none of us are soothsayers, that I'm going to get them the second line therapy if they need that second line therapy. But I'm still a big proponent of immunotherapy alone for the high PD-L1 expressors, even though we have the data available to us to really give any therapy we want, any combination thereof. But I think you're right. There hasn't been any kind of rip-roaring new indications or data, but kind of some reassurance in some of these five-year outcomes and beyond, knowing that that plateau on the curve is real and that some 20%, 25%-ish of patients really are going to enjoy long-term survival. Some nuances about re-challenging if they stopped after 2 years. But I think the other kind of maybe the things to pick out in the recent updates have been a little more reassurance that the CTLA-4 PD-L1 signal of benefit, interestingly for the PD-L1 non-expressors, remember, for whom Nivo-Ipi is not technically approved, though it's on the NCCN, there was that signal that they kind of do better than you expect. And that was replicated in the Poseidon study when you have Durva and Tremi with chemo as well. So I think it's for those who are inclined toward double immunotherapy with or without chemo and intrigued by that less than PD-L1 less of 1% subpopulation, I think now we have two sets of data that kind of replicate that long-term benefit.
Here's the Poseidon study that you were talking about. Again, another CTLA-4 PD-1 strategy that kind of looks encouraging. What are you doing nowadays when you have PD-1 zero patients, first-line metastatic disease?
I talk about some of these data. I work in the Bay Area. I have a lot of people averse to chemo. And so if there's any plausible approach that's chemo-free, they're often kind of more all ears about it. And so the patients in whom I've used the double immunotherapy have tended to be either PD-L1 less than 1% or people who really can't get chemo or who just say, I am not going to get chemo in shared decision making. But yeah, you're showing these data, the less than 1%, that forest plot still is showing that we're seeing that the CTLA-4 PD-L1 combination seems to have some benefit. And here you have this is the overall survival data. It's kind of intriguing here that the hazard ratio 0.76 is favorable to the durvalumab alone arm. So, you know, those numbers, the absolute levels of the hazard ratio, I'd say that 0.84 seems to underperform a little bit compared to other PD-1/PD-L1 with chemo studies that were on the other slide. So I'm not sure that might be the underperformer rather than the other one being the overperformer, but it's definitely intriguing. And I think at least, again, it's a wild west. We don't have head-to-head data. I'm not sure we will in the next few years. You kind of have support for the approach you want to take.
What about the patient where you're kind of reluctant to use chemo, kind of on the fence about whether or not they might be able to tolerate chemo? And a strategy actually that I see used in prostate cancer, where you start out with a treatment and then you intensify if the patient doesn't do well. So prostate, they add in more hormones. But what about starting out with PD-1 and then adding, yeah?
Absolutely. In fact, I've had several patients where I start with the PD-L1 alone because of the high, with PD-L1 inhibition alone because of the high PD-L1. And if they have, they don't have a good response, I will then kick in the chemo with cycle 3. I always do a first image after two cycles, six weeks. It's a little early, but on almost all the immunotherapy trials, at least in lung, on the spaghetti plots, you're seeing your lack of benefit or benefit by that first time point. So it's not unusual for me to kind of talk to patients about an early intensification if there's a hint of progression early on.
Any flavor to the autoimmune toxicity that you think you're seeing in lung cancer patients with combination immunotherapy that maybe you wouldn't see in a younger melanoma patient or, you know, other situations where, for example, you know, like in HCC, you have durva-tremi, but, you know, lower dose, et cetera. What do you see when you bring in CTLA-4 in a lung cancer patient? Anything in terms of toxicity that's characteristic, or just like, you know, I hear a lot about colitis.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think colitis is, in my experience, been pretty rare for PD-1 or PD-L1 single inhibition, whereas we've seen several cases with dual inhibition. That's probably the most prominent. I personally haven't seen a huge bump in terms of pneumonitis rates, which is another big concern in our clinics, but I don't think it's a marked difference.
I was thinking again about how lung cancer so often, you know, kind of leads the way because there's just so many patients. And then when something happens, you know, it's really, and I was just thinking that where we're heading here today, the last thing we're going to talk about is kind of the, you know, PD-1 all over again, because you guys are the first one with a CD3 bispecific for Tarlatamab. So you led the way with IOs, and it looks like if we're going to see CD3 bispecific, which is, of course, a whole huge area of tolerability that oncologists are dealing with now in myeloma and lymphoma, maybe we're going to see that also in lung cancer coming up in the near future. All right, let's talk about some new agents, and one in particular, datopotamab deruxtecan, which, you know, has been presented both for breast, and we were just talking about breast the other day, but also in non-small cell lung cancer as well. A lot of people think this drug may get approved, but we've been seeing more and more data alone with IO, also in people with targetable lesions, that I think is very interesting. The side effect profile is interesting. So, you know, if this does get approved, I'm not exactly sure whether we're ready in terms of when to use it, how to use it, and particularly the tolerability as issues, but let's take a jump into this and maybe you can help prepare us for it. So first, I want to talk a little bit about, go for it.
It's kind of amazing how quickly these ADC trials have been, the drugs have been developed and the trial programs have been developed. I mean, we're talking so many trials in parallel, enrolling so many patients. I feel like it's the immunotherapy experience, but maybe over half the time frame. It's really remarkable. As you'd imagine, go ahead.
I was just going to say, just to mention another thing I'd like you to kind of bring in is, A, I mentioned before, you know, people with targetable mutations who get beyond targeted therapy. But another thing that we saw some data on that, again, everybody asks about with everything, including ADCs, is CNS. And we saw some data there in CNS disease at ASCO. So we picked out a bunch of slides, but I just really wanted you to just talk about it in terms of what you think about the data and if the drug is approved, how you think you might use it.
Well, keep in mind, kind of the TROP2 is, I think, the first set of molecules that are kind of first to get their studies accrued and get some data out there. And I kind of think of Dato-DXd and sacituzumab govitecan kind of neck and neck in there. And it was really in this last year where we got the Dato-DXd data, the TROPION-Lung01 here. This is randomized against docetaxel, our eternal foe for second line. Docetaxel beats almost everything, you know. And yet here, the overall study showed that the Dato-DXd beat docetaxel, but when you looked at the subgroups, there was this marked difference. So even though the overall, you know, the primary endpoint was PFS in all comers, when you looked at non-squam versus squam, there's this very disparate signal where non-squamous folks, with including patients who had these actionable genomic alterations, who did even better than average, actually did quite well, whereas on the squamous side, there was maybe even a deleterious effect. So I think this is a really fascinating thing that I'm not sure was predicted a priori and actually wasn't replicated, for example, in the sacituzumab govitecan similar study, the EVOKE study that was presented at ASCO. Now, then you start wondering, is it something about the patient population? Is it something about the molecule? You always have to think about these molecules as you've got the target, you've got the payload, you got the linker. There's a lot of kind of variables there. And one wonders is it an irinotecan-based difference versus topoisomerase 1 difference? You know, the payload, is it something about the design elsewhere? It's just fascinating, right? But anyway, so I think you're right that I have no inside line. This was a positive study, though it was a subgroup that really was the primary driver of that positivity. Are we going to see a broad approval, at least for non-squamous, of this new drug, and with it, all the toxicities and logistics we need to know to really use it when it's a better drug than the docetaxel we've been using for a decade and more.
So, you know, we'll talk a little bit about the tolerability issues that have to be considered, but just sort of sticking a little bit with, you know, in terms of where or if to place this drug. And you mentioned the negative sacituzumab study also, which is important to consider. It, you would think if it's going to get approved, it maybe it's going to get approved in non-squamous. And I guess the question, first of all, in terms of efficacy, I mean, any questions about it? And I guess, is this a, whether it's a post-hoc analysis, I don't know if that colors the way you look at it. But certainly if the study had only had non-squamous in there, we wouldn't be right. having much question about it.
Right.
But you I know, guess we'll no see with the loss. FDA and it's just...
Right. There's no love lost for docetaxel, right? You know, it's been our second line for a long time, and no one loves a taxane. It's what we have when we don't have much else. So I think there'll be some gentle interest in something that beats docetaxel somewhat. You saw some kind of early OS data that might be trending in the right direction, but I think that one of what we'll talk a bit about toxicities as you were showing on the slides. But I think the other thing that really both the sponsors and all of us are asking the question of, well, if it beats docetaxel a little bit in the second line, is there any advantage to having it as part of a first line regimen? No one's going to not do immunotherapy, but the phase three trial designs have all the permutations of one of these ADCs plus immunotherapy, ADC plus platinum plus immunotherapy. Those data, which are very much accruing and I think maturing quickly, we're going to see some phase three first line readouts in PD-L1 less than 50%, greater than 50%. In both of these TROP2 agents and others in the next year or two. So I think it's this might be the first kind of foot in the door, but I think we're going to have to reckon with these drugs and their logistics and their toxicities, because they're going to be a part of the process, even as we refine the technology and hopefully eventually figure out how to design our ADCs better, you know, and have the right payloads and the right targets.
And my head is still ringing because I did a recording earlier today with Sarah Tolaney on ADCs in breast cancer, and all the trials she was talking about was ADC plus IO.
Right.
And of course, you know, bladder cancer, that's first line therapy, you know, and fortamab plus pembro beat cisplatin based chemotherapy, and wondering whether that might be the direction.
That next line, I think you're about to show. And again, I think whenever we incorporate any of these ADCs, and that includes, you know, trastuzumab deruxtecan for our HER2 patients, eventually some HER3 ADCs, you got to really pay attention to these toxicity profiles. They're not unmanageable. They're just, you have to recognize them prophylactically, anticipate them, have your staff, including APPs and RNs, kind of be on the lookout for them. And then the three things that stick out here, as you see, mucositis is real. It can be kind of proactively dealt with. And I think they've done some nice studies about using a steroid mouthwash from day one to kind of head some of this off at the pass. Secondly, ocular events. I think that strikes fear in the heart of a lot of us oncologists. And these days, I don't know about other people's facilities, it's really hard to get in the door of an optometrist or ophthalmologist. They are, I think they're busier than we are. And so if you have a patient who has a legitimate eye issue, I think all of us, our hackles are raised a bit. And then ILD, which I tend to think, you know, obviously I defer to my breast colleagues, I think we have to worry about that a little more than they do, just because A, I think our patients are at higher risk of it, but also B, we have more of a diagnostic dilemma, because what if it's recurrence? What if it's edema? What if it's radiation pneumonitis? You know, so all those questions don't mean this drug is not going to be used and shouldn't be used. It just means we have to kind of be ready for these issues as they arise in a way that I don't think we've had to for some of the other drugs in our armamentarium.
So, yeah, and Sarah was claiming, as you just said, that they are able to prevent the mucositis very effectively. According to her, of course, they developed that strategy with the steroids for breast cancer. And in terms of ophthalmic guy, we're all over it. We're ready.
Yeah.
We're already ready. We've already done a CME program just on ophthalmic issues with ADCs.
Great.
We're ready.
I mean,
you guys aren't ready.
We're not ready, but you are.
You're not ready, but everybody else is. And Good. Who knows? I mean, I don't even understand Good. Half of the stuff there, but at least we know what to do, at least who to talk to. And the other issues, I guess, will get ironed out as we move forward. What about the issue? There are two other things I was curious about, and we saw data looking at this. You know, one was the issue of so first of all, you're seeing in the Tropion study looking at first-line therapy, and we were starting to see some data there. Again, looking at it with IO, I'm curious about your thoughts on that. Also, in terms of biomarkers that predict benefit in this situation, we saw some data, ASCO, looking at that. Audience, you can check out these slides later on, but I just want Matt to talk about it. This very important data set that we saw last fall at ESMO, looking again, this population of people with targetable lesions, but after they get through targeted therapy, which I thought was great that they looked at that, particularly because it seems to work better with non-squamous, and it looks like it works well in those patients. And then finally at ASCO, we saw data on CNS activity. So any thoughts about CNS activity? Yeah, so how about all this stuff with Dato?
Yeah, well, I think this has just been neat, not just with Dato, but, you know, even with trastuzumab deruxtecan. You know, who knew 5 years ago that these huge multi-molecules are going to have a CNS benefit? But we're seeing it across these programs, and it's very encouraging. Now, do you hang your hat on it? You're still going to call the radiation oncologist. But to know that in a disease where brain metastases play a pretty big role in morbidity and mortality, it's just good to know we have some activity up there, right? I think the French group study that you kind of flashed through, Dr. Blanchard's study, it's kind of interesting, you know, for HER2, it's so important to either in lung cancer have the mutation or have high expression. We don't have this kind of minimal HER2 expression where we can give a HER2 ADC. It's so fascinating, you know, not for lack of trying, that it just hasn't seemed that TROP2 expression plays a significant role in the benefit for these drugs. And so that's going to really differ by target. You mentioned the BiTE that we'll talk about that in a minute in the small cell. You know, DLL3 expression is important in a small cell lung cancer, but it's not actually part of the FDA label. So again, it's going to differ by ADC. It's going to differ by mechanism, but again, just all these, we're going to have this table in our head that keeps growing and growing, not just of the parameters of the drugs, but what kind of factors to look out for. But pretty neat correlative science going on there.
So I'm trying to wade through all this stuff and find the things that people need to know to take care of patients right now, and it's a challenge because there's so much stuff to look at. Let's talk about this population out there who does have a targetable mutation. What do we do once they get beyond that, and particularly where immunotherapy fits in? Also, new agents, there's a TKI I'm curious about. I'm not sure how to pronounce it, serolasertib, that's been combined with an IO, durvalumab. But first, can you talk a little bit about the issue of, you know, this sort of classic, well, now it's a classic conundrum of people who respond to targeted therapy, i.e., for example, EGFR, and then progress?
Yeah, so, you know, from the early days of immunotherapy, maybe not quite 9 years ago, but maybe 7 to 8 years ago, there were EGFR and ALK patients who were getting these, you know, later line single agent immunotherapies. And just every study showed a response rate that was in the low single digits, if any. So we just know that even if those patients express high PD-L1, the biology of these tumors don't favor that particular checkpoint being part of the pathogenesis. And so what this study happens to be kind of a retrospective paper that we did looking at across our University of California campuses and just kind of looking at patients who got these. We were doing it practically because what else do we have at nth line? And we just really didn't see a PFS or OS benefit, even in our retrospective data, kind of replicating what had been seen before, and maybe even a deleterious effect for EGFR patients after a TKI. Again, this whole question about overlapping toxicity. But I would draw to your attention, we didn't pull the slides. There was a neat paper presented that we're going to have to see how it pans out. The harm A trial. This was the ivonescimab. This is the bispecific against PD-1 and VEGF. So kind of, you know, we've known for a long time, and this is an EGFR patients after osimertinib progression. It's a Chinese phase 3 trial, now enrolling rest of world patients because of how provocative the results are. This is a patient population we don't think of PD-L1 as having a lot of benefit. VEGF has always kind of had this nebulous role where maybe it's good added to TKI, never with OS benefit, maybe good in subsequent lines. But this bispecific, there's a marked PFS benefit in that post-TKI line of therapy. So I'll be very curious. I know it's actively enrolling rest of world, partly for the FDA's sake, to get some data to replicate outside of China. But that was one of the more provocative lung papers at ASCO. And I'm sorry we didn't pull those. It's my fault for neglecting that. But especially as we talk about targeted people with genomic alterations who need non-targeted therapy eventually. That was a very provocative paper.
You're talking about a bispecific that attaches the VEGF and PD-1?
Exactly. Yep. Yep. Ivonescimab.
That sounds like
Ivonescimab.
That sounds like a good idea.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah.
That sounds like a good idea.
Well, sign on.
No, never heard of it, but it's
phase three trial. Really, you know, well done. Kind of post TKI EGFR patients. So kind of interesting. So we'll pull that and keep an eye on. There is, again, like I say, there's another part of that study that will enroll enough ex-China patients that the FDA will at least look at the data if it looks as positive. Pretty nifty.
But I mean, did they see single agent responses?
It was this bispecific plus chemo versus chemo plus
chemo.
Yeah. It's kind of like we're looking in the EGFR space of chemo with TKI, chemo with EGFR MET bispecific. So it's kind of in the mix there. So kind of interesting. Anyway, be that as it may, I think your point's well taken, both for the immunotherapies and for the ADCs. We have to think about these patients differently and kind of, even if they're included in the trials, stratify by them or at least have really good subgroup analyses of them, because you had pointed out before the ADC benefit. Here's this trial that has some benefit with VEGF. We just have to pay attention to that over time, I think.
So, yeah, I guess this is sort of the same kind of strategy, except with two different drugs rather than a bispecific. But any comments? I don't know if there's a nickname for CIRA, but the TKI plus Durva, any thoughts about it?
Well, it's an ATR inhibitor, and I think if you scroll to the next page, you know, it's all these studies looking at a post-immunotherapy failure kind of situation, right? And all we have brewing in lung cancer right now in kind of that phase three setting really is TIGIT and then kind of VEGF, right? So we're looking at those two phase three studies actively accruing and soon to report out. But I think, you know, this study design, you can tell how small the print is. How can we think about precision oncology and think about what we can add to immunotherapy? So as you see, you know, KRAS versus non-actionable mutations, both getting the Durva plus ATR inhibitor. And there's a there. I mean, it's modest, 13% versus 4.5%. This is, mind you, compared to a docetaxel with, you know, kind of high single digit, you know, a response rate. So is there enough of a there for this to kind of get to later phases? Maybe. But it's among the many efforts to kind of throw something plus immunotherapy in that post-immunotherapy failure line.
So we may circle back to, we're getting some cool questions in the chat room, but I want to make sure we get through to small cell, and then maybe you can loop back for some of these other issues, because it's kind of interesting stuff going on here with small cell, beginning with the plenary session here, the Adria.
Yes.
Again, not a big surprise.
No.
I kind of wondered, do we really need to wait? We waited like 5 years for this. But
keep in mind, we don't see that many of these patients. I think the only reason we're seeing more limited stage small cell is because of screening efforts being a little more ambitious and widespread. They're not widespread enough in the U.S., but this isn't that frequent in our clinics to actually find a patient who has limited stage disease. But like you say, I don't think this surprised anyone, but it's very good to have the data in hand to say that just as we anticipate immunotherapy ongoing in the metastatic or extensive stage setting, here in 2 years of durvalumab clearly made a difference.
So, and again, I think everybody saw these data, and not too unexpected. Anything, you know, you want to say in general about the use of IOs in people with small cell? I mean, obviously, we've been using it now for a few years in combination with chemotherapy. Any observations? Have you seen any long-term responders? Anything different in terms of the kind of autoimmune problems they develop? You know, they're often sick people with a lot of tumor-related symptoms. Anything you want to say in general about your experience with IOs and small cell?
I think it still feels like, even though there are some of those longer term survivors, and I have a handful of them, that tail on the curve is a little lower than it is in non-small cell lung cancer, despite all our hopes and prayers that these are often tobacco exposed, very highly mutagenic, but not quite as many. Dr. Liu, of course, presented a nice long-term outcomes paper on the atezolizumab, you know, folks. And there is a subset of patients at 2 and 3 and 5 years, but it's a smaller proportion. I think how that fits into Adriatic is the question, you give these people 2 years of immunotherapy, just as we ask after a Atezo or Durva failure in the extensive stage setting, what's next? Are these patients we have to go straight to the BiTE for? Do we re-challenge if it's been a spell? That's probably what I would do initially, but I think that those are some of the questions remain to be answered. And I think a lot of the interesting data that not ready for prime time, but this subtyping of small cell to say maybe there's a subtype of small cell where immunotherapy is particularly likely to be helpful from the get-go, and others where maybe you need to bring in a PARP inhibitor or bring in other mechanisms of action, if not in the first line, in rapid access second line. I think that's some of the more provocative work happening.
So,
Dr. Liu's study.
Right. Anything you want to say about this more further follow up from the Caspian study?
Yeah, to this day, my couple of longest term survivors were the people who got Nevo Ipi as not even second line, but like nth line. For whatever reason, a couple other investigators have mentioned that too. And obviously that approval kind of fell by the wayside, but one wonders. And that data set was kind of interesting in seeing that there were some folks, it wasn't predicted by PD-L1, but who had some nice long chemo plus dual blockade of PD-1 and CTLA-4. So and again, here's the AT4 inhibitor rearing its head again. Here's
right,
another. Again, I think here, is there one of these subgroups, one of these four subgroups identified by the MD Anderson and other teams that maybe this is the right approach from the beginning or again, in early relapsed refractory disease? I think this is early, but certainly provocative for a tumor that still needs our help. But this is where the exciting stuff is happening, this BiTE. And again, we've kind of joked that maybe it's good that the first BiTE or cellular therapy in lung is in a small cell population, because at least we have time to prepare a smaller patient population. These are logistics that my hospital is literally working on this week. I have a meeting on Friday about how are we going to operationalize this drug that requires a couple of hospitalizations and a different kind of CRS monitoring than we've ever had to do in solid tumors. Pretty exciting to have this data set come out and the approval very recently. I think we're a month into this approval. And again, 40% response rate in a heavily pretreated population, a real significant overall survival. This is a very exciting development, but logistically, it's a bit of a handful.
So, well, the good news is the oncology community is going to be ready for you because they've been working on this the last 2 years in myeloma and lymphoma.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
You just need to talk to the lymphoma and myeloma people. Yeah. I'm not sure that the tolerability issues, if they sound like pretty similar to what we've been hearing.
Very similar.
CRS, cytokine release syndrome. Of course, one of the issues is how cytokine release syndrome going to go down in a patient with COPD and heart disease
compared to a young patient
with lymphoma.
Any thoughts about that? And I don't think we have data on that, but one always wonders as we start extrapolating this randomized controlled trial this registrational trial, to the real world where, I have patients on a list waiting to get on this, but they're the patients who've been waiting and they've been through multiple lines and they're a little beaten up by some past therapies. So one wonders. I think we're too early on to really know how much different the CRS, for example, experience is going to be, but we have to be ready.
I mean, when you were talking about what are the new trials in upfront therapy, I thought the next thing out of your mouth was going to be adding this thing in.
Not quite, but it's coming. It's coming, right? I think it's still, we need to get our sea legs on a drug like this, but I think that's the next step. And remember, DLL3, that's been a provocative target for a long time. I think, Rova-T, I think we probably, in this setting, talked to a bunch of us how excited we were. Didn't pan out, speaking of ADCs, where we didn't quite have the biology right. But this is kind of that first commercial application of DLL3, and we're very excited about it.
Yeah, we had John Haymock on a video at ASCO, and he was talking about work they had done there where I guess they showed, so I want to quote him correctly, that they saw that they could detect DLL3 in, I think it was people who had EGFR and then progressed on osimertinib. Maybe I'm thinking, or no, that would have been small cell. Sorry, I'm thinking about small cell here. But in any event, they found DLL3 and think that, it should work, I guess, maybe outside of small cell potentially. Have you seen any trials looking at that?
Well, keep in mind that small cell transformation is one of our more aggressive, not that common, but
that's
not uncommon.
That's what he was talking about.
So I think there's been this interest. Obviously, the biggest place for develop these drugs has been in small cell, but there's a whole range of high-grade neuroendocrines, including in prostate resistance, EGFR-driven, and other targetable alterations resistance, that I think that's a logical next step. Some of those patients were on the Rova-T studies back in the day, some of the other DLL3 compounds. So one wonders if that's kind of the next step for one of these drugs. Yeah.
Yeah, actually, that was what he was looking at. It was people who had EGFR who transformed to small cell, and they saw DLL3.
Those patients are very hard to treat. They have terrible prognosis. Right. We kind of throw some platinum etoposide at them. We debate whether to leave on the osimertinib, and they do okay, but not for long. So one wonders if, especially in that fitter population, maybe this is the perfect next line therapy when someone like Dr. Amak can show us, hey, there's actually some plausible biomarker here that might suggest its benefit. So we would be all ears for that kind of approach.
So oncologists are getting a lot of experience, or at least they're hearing a lot about cytokine release syndrome. Actually, I'm not sure how many people of their patients are actually gotten treated yet, but they certainly are hearing about cytokine release syndrome. But the other thing they're hearing about, again, you hear this with CAR-T too, is neurologic issues. Mm-hmm. Do you know whether or not they've seen that with this tarlatamab?
They have, but not at some of the high rates of some of the approved CAR T cell products, thankfully. And I think, again, for this patient population where we worry, as you mentioned, about some of the neurologic paraneoplastic syndromes that are already on board, one was kind of maybe concerned about that. But really, the CRS has been relatively manageable. And to the point where I know they're looking at right now you admit the patient for the first two doses, but there's even some kind of some logistic work to be done to maybe make those just long outpatient stays. So to do that this early in the development for this patient population is suggestive that at least this particular bite's not going to be the worst of the bites that we've all seen in the heme side.
Well, there's also well-tolerated bites on the heme side, though. You have mosunetuzumab, where I hear people using outpatient corticosteroids for low-grade CRS. So I don't know if that is going to happen with lung cancer as well. Question from the chat room. When we did a program about this recently, B7H3 ADCs. What's B7H3, and do you see any future for those? Also, patritumab deruxtecan is another ADC we've heard about. I've heard about that with, again, EGFR progression. What about some of these other ADCs? Do you see those coming into lung cancer?
Definitely. And, the results have been fairly mixed. And you have to look at, again, how much of it is the target of choice, how much of it is the payload of choice. So with your second question, patritumab deruxtecan, I think we're all eagerly awaiting. That's en route probably to some approval. Again, really gratifyingly in the EGFR later line population. There's this kind of HER3 kind of that makes some sense that there might be some homology enough where that would be of use. And we've seen some good data. Again, we love our osimertinib, but when we get past the TKI benefit, we start running out of tools pretty quickly. So I think there's a lot of enthusiasm for that one in particular. B7H3 and others on the list, CACAM, is also one of them that has been looked at in lung cancer that are overexpressed in lung, along with a bunch of others. Mesothelin has been kind of looked at in lung and, of course, in mesothelioma, including in CAR T cells. So the field is vast. The question is, how do you signal find quickly to not have to run a whole lot of phase 3 trials for a negative result, but to really to hone in on the signals that actually work? But those are all in play.
So one final ADC I'd like to ask you about. Technically, it doesn't fit. I never know where to put this, whether it's a target or non-targeted, but that's TDXD.
Right. And course, I struggle with that even in my ASCO talk. Is it an actual genomic alteration? Now the approval includes lung with 3+ expression too. So yeah, is that targeted? It's not an AGA quite, but it's in the same vein. But I always make that differential point that unlike breast where minimal, trace HER2 might be enough to give that drug, we really need high levels of expression to anticipate some benefit. And then of course, in our use of that drug, we're very enthusiastic about it, especially in the mutated patient, in the HER2 mutation, driven tumors, really good outcomes, but always with the back of our head, mindful about the pneumonitis risk, because that's a real, I'm worried more about that than cardiotoxicity. I've seen more of that in at least in my experience. So something that's maybe a little differentially needing attention in the lung population getting TDXD versus the breast population or the gastric population.
I think anybody getting TDXD is going to get a lot of people looking at their lungs for sure, very carefully. Yeah. But also, you know, it's used a lot, and you see mm-hmm. patient after patient, you know, who really has, you know, palpable clinical benefit. Oh,
I have a patient two years out with brain mets. You know, when this was her second line therapy, and it's just very gratifying to see. She has tremendous quality of life, and knock on wood, her echoes and her scans continue to look good. So, no, this is a really important tool in armamentarium, and the addition of the pan tumor HER3 amplification indication, I think, is really useful. And the lung data are robust there. Not as robust as a mutation, interestingly, but robust enough to say, I want that second line before I'm trifling with docetaxel and some of the less specific ADCs.
We could have spent the whole hour just on TDXD. And on Thursday, when we do triple negative, we also are going to get into this because of, you know, one of the cases there where the patient has a HER2 mutation, and they don't have any data in breast cancer with HER2, but they say, what about lung cancer? Because you guys are already using it.
Yeah.
Then this pan tumor approval comes in, and now we're looking for IHC3+ in lung cancer patients. So again, a lot to talk about there, but a really important option that now is available to a lot of patients, including a lot of patients with lung cancer. Anyhow, Matt, I knew it was going to be a crazy wild hour, and it was.
As always. Lung ASCO is always exciting.
I hope you all got something out of this, but I think there are a lot of things that are very positive that came out of this. It's always a challenge to sort of sort through it. Hopefully it was helpful to you today. Coming back tomorrow, we're going to try the same thing with renal cell cancer with Drs. McKay and Professor Powles. Matt, thanks so much for working with us today. Audience, coming back tomorrow night. We'll see what's going on with renal cell cancer. Be safe, stay well, and have a great evening. Thanks so much, Matt.
Take care. Thank you.